rock a chill. They say I'm nasty, but I don't.
Hi, this is John Amundson, and I would like to present, I think it's about the 377th podcast presented for you by the Psychologist Association of Alberta. The purpose of the podcast is to present information that's timely, topical, and even controversial to the membership, and to give an aging psychologist something to do. I'm going to cover a couple of different articles today, and the first one has to do with mindfulness and neurofeedback. Often my work centers around certain clinical issues, and for those that have listened to podcasts in the past, I've been critically skeptical of the neurofeedback movement. A billion years ago, I was the president of the first Behavioral Health and Biofeedback Society in Alberta. Now, this goes way back into the, I want to say the 70s, and maybe not even into the early 80s. We had a big movement around biofeedback, and I was a great proponent of biofeedback at that time. Took a 120-hour certification course through the Biofeedback Institute of America. Had really, really chased that, and wrote a quick article. I think it was in Symposium in those days where I said the results of biofeedback ought to be greater than just the twinkle in a clinician's eye. A twinkle in the clinician's eye that is reflective of the shiny surface of a biofeedback instrument. Something along those lines. I did a podcast a while back on this issue of the article that was in the American Psychologist that was done by, I think, a couple of researchers in Quebec, Canadian researchers for sure, who were looking at biofeedback. In the old days, today it's neurofeedback. And they were, looking at the absence of results or other explanations for the results that existed. There was also an article, a rebuttal published that defended neurofeedback and on and on. We say it's not a binary issue, it is continuous, and there ought to be skepticism. So the lead in here has to do with an article that was published in Clinical Psychology, Science, and Practice, and it was looking at a systematic review considering mindfulness interventions and neurofeedback for targeting affective and cognitive processes in behavioral addictions. So this walks into a bunch of areas, addiction and self-regulatory mechanisms that would be associated with relief or clinical success regarding addictive behaviors. And the reason I have started by looking at neurofeedback is they concluded there was no research that they could find on neurofeedback, meaning, I guess, no research they could include in this review. They looked at PubMed, Scopus, Web of Knowledge, et cetera, et cetera. And they could not find anything that would be included in their and suitable for their analysis. What they did find, though, that four of the six studies with the biggest effects for mindfulness, it's a mindfulness cognitive-based therapy, were found to be successful in reducing cravings, reducing the compelling nature of these behavioral components of addiction. So scoring something for, I've been critical of skeptically critical of mindfulness as well in terms of its sort of blanket importation into clinical practice. So score a little bit for mindfulness, and we're still waiting to see what neurofeedback might do for us. Being with a neuro focus or a psychophysiological focus, there was a cool article in the there's a journal by APA called Practice Innovations, and the article was a psychological approach to medically unexplained somatic symptoms, and the author concludes that there is a place for psychologists in their treatment, and a way to understand them is through somatization. Maladaptive emotional regulation being the foundation of that. I have spoken to patients, and also I believe in earlier podcasts, to the concept of psychophysiological disorder. And this has to do with the same thing that this author is talking about, somatization. And instead of it being the old school, it's all in your head, that's PPD, psychophysiological disorder, speaks about the dysregulation that exists in the sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system, such that a patient is stuck either with a feeling of driving with the gas pedal stuck down, or trying to drive with one foot on the brake. Both of those metaphors, both of those ways of thinking about it, then are continually putting a degree of stress on the peripheral nervous system, the autonomic nervous system. As a result, there can be production of symptoms in the musculoskeletal, in the gastrointestinal, cardiac, even dermatological sorts of issues. So that rather than it being this kind of, the person is doing it for secondary gain, they're making it up, it is just simply a way of garnering agency or attention or one or another of these sort of more lame ways to treat a patient. We talk about, oh no, this is just where your nervous system has been subject to twerking based upon predisposition, biological genetic predisposition, but certainly also through the cumulative effect of events in developmental years, and then the cumulative effect of exposure to events that would lead to that kind of arousal, that idea of feeling flight, fight, freeze. This is my, brake stuck, or rather gas pedal stuck, the brake pedal suppressed in their nervous system, and then the wear and tear that comes with that over years, which can produce that those physiological effects and responses. So though he uses the term somatization, I think it's really cool to talk to patients about the psychophysiological disorder that is existent. Back to the body, there was an article in the Journal of Psychology of Religion and Spirituality, and this article just grabbed at me. It was A Meaning Behind the Movement, Attributing Sacred Meaning to Fluid and Non-Fluid Arm Movements Increases Self-Transcendence, Positive Emotions, and Buffers the Effect of Non-Fluidity on Positive Emotions. Okay, essentially what they found was that if you could attribute to arm movements sacred meaning, it would lead to greater experiences of positive and self-transcendent positive emotions and lower negative emotions, and protects against non-fluid movement, that is, rigidity. So you all know Tai Chi, right? And so one of the benefits of Tai Chi, it would, according to this study, is that when the person is moving their arms in the Tai Chi fashion, I'm sitting here kind of doing it while I'm recording this, that they're attributing to that this sort of sacredness, that this has to do with the flow of Chi or Ki through the body, and one is getting in touch with that. And so that this sense of arm movement, where there's an attribution to it of something that is transcendent or sacred. Maybe you don't know, but I have had number of articles published in the Journal of the American Society for Clinical Hypnosis. And my feeling about hypnosis, I've discussed this before in podcasts, is that a placebo with a main effect produces better outcome than one without. And so that I see hypnosis as a very powerful placebo response. Hang on, I'm going to turn this off while I call. I've used arm movements as a means of, quote, trance induction to evoke this change in one's sensate experience. And I've had them move their arms, and I've talked about it as being, you know, working with an unconscious sense, letting their arms move freely in order to enact this a volitional state of mind that goes with hypnosis. I think I'm wandering too far afield. But I like that article because they say, you know, have their arms move and have it be associated with sacredity, a sacredness, and people, it reduces negative and increases positive emotions. Departing now a little bit from physicality, I want to end the podcast with another article that that I thought was pretty charming. And it was published in The Psychology of Aesthetics, Creativity, and the Arts. And the title of the article is Who Hates Magic? And they were looking at people who hate magic. And I guess apparently there is a robust cohort of folks who truly hate magic. So they're trying to look at what are the psychological dimensions and characteristics of these individuals. And in a multinational sample of 1,600 adults, people who hated magic were marked by lower openness to experience and lower awe proneness, higher dogmatism, intolerance of uncertainty, and personal need for structure, and higher socially aversive traits. What is that means? Lower agreeableness, greater interpersonal dominance, and higher psychopathy. I think what this means is if you're a magician, don't ever accept a gig as the opening act at a Donald Trump political rally. Let's let the magic flute then march us out.